This is the July 11 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online at WILLAG.org. Our panelists for the program today include Tommy Grisafi. He is with Advanced Trading out of Mayville, North Dakota, from right here in Fargo, North Dakota, and we're recording at the Bush Ag Resources Malt Plant that belongs to Anheuser-Busch and their Growers Day, and we're joined by Randy Martinson of Martinson Ag Risk Management, along with NDSU Ag Marketing Specialist, Frayne Olson. Let's start with you, Frayne. How did you receive this morning's USDA numbers?
They came in pretty much like I expected them, and well within the trading ranges. I didn't expect to see any major adjustments in the acreage numbers. I know there's some debate about that. When the June acreage report came out, WASD has a habit of just following those numbers, those NAS numbers. And again, the reason is if they don't use those numbers, what numbers do they use? And so from a policy standpoint, from a historical standpoint, they have been using those numbers for a while now, or that process for a while. I guess when I was looking at the numbers, I was also looking to see if they had made any adjustments primarily on the usage side. I didn't expect to see any big shocks on the production side, but I was looking for adjustments on the usage side, in particular kind of those export numbers. Does USDA see any shifts going on or potential shifts in the export market that we might be looking for, again, shifting production levels around the world? And we got some minor adjustments, but nothing major.
So what were those adjustments like?
On the usage side, so the export numbers, I guess kind of the surprise to me was the export number for wheat was up. And that was primarily because of some adjustments downward in the size of the Russian wheat production. That reduction was a little bit larger than I guess I was expecting them to have, but it was that was a corresponding increase in wheat exports. Small adjustments in U.S. Feed usage. There was a small adjustment in the export of soybeans, and again that one doesn't surprise me a lot. I do think given some of the negotiations going on now with the trade agreements, the slow pace that we have for not only old crop but potentially new crop export sales, I guess it didn't make a. It didn't surprise me a lot that they took it down. They took it down a little further than I expected.
Randy from Martinson Ag, your assessment early on when you first saw those numbers and then how they impacted the marketplace?
Well, I was kind of surprised at seeing some of the numbers. And one of them that I figured the numbers would be a little bit more bearish on the wheat side of things. And it actually turned out to be somewhat friendly to wheat. And that was because, as Frayne mentioned, the increase in the exports for the new crop. Old crop, you know, and the feed demand going up. And we knew there had to be some adjustment in there just because of the stocks being lowered in the quarterly grain stocks estimates. But corn, rightfully so, they decreased the exports for old crop by 100 million. That was needed because we're not going to make pace of the old crop side of things. As Frayne mentioned, the new crop numbers for corn were as expected. We knew they were going to use the WASD was going to use the NAS numbers. For soybeans, I was surprised as how friendly it was to the soybean side. Seeing stocks cut by 250 million bushels was a good sign. It's a good step forward, even though we still have, you know, 700 million bushels of ending stocks for soybeans. It's a friendlier picture, and I think once we get a little bit better handle of the real acres and the real yield, that number is going to get tighter.
So this wheat number did push the market higher, at least for that particular commodity. Is that good news for corn over the longer run?
Well, wheat had the opportunity to bounce. It was so oversold or on sale, right? So when I can buy Minneapolis wheat futures for 50 cents under where our producers can produce it, I kind of feel guilty, right? So as a speculator, I can buy wheat futures cheaper than they can produce it. To bounce 15 cents, it doesn't mean our growers are making money. They're just losing less. So wheat had the dead cat bounce, and that's what wheat does. Wheat could be the hardest commodity in the world to trade. No one understands it. They grow. It's not that you understand or don't. They grow it in every country in the world, right? So when it comes to corn and beans, we're the real deal, and there's only a few other countries that can even try to compete with us. So what's interesting in all this, though, is that for people who love to know what's going to happen and they crunch numbers, this year is going to be one of the most confusing numbers, confusing years they've ever had. And for people who like to know, I want to know what's going on. Well, there's five things you don't know yet, and you're not going to know for a long time. And we talked a lot about that before we started talking. And it's going to be a great year. And for guys like Randy and myself and Doctor, who's a teaching, you know, professor from university, this is where you can actually use the tools of the market to your advantage and keep that upside.
So Tommy Grassoffi says there's things that we don't know that you should use the tools of the market, Dr. Olson. What tools should producers in your part of the world use, and how do they differ, if at all, from those that are in the Eastern Corn Belt?
Well, one of the things that we have up here is a much more volatile basis levels, local basis levels, than you typically see in the Corn Belt. You know, for us to have from the low to the high of the year in basis, to have a, you know, a 50-cent swing in basis is not unusual. And so I know of farmers not only in the wheat market but also in corn and beans who will make as much money in change in basis as they do in their underlying hedging strategies. So that's one of the big differences. And so up here we really do need to separate what's happening in the futures market versus what's happening locally. And part of that is shipping and where we're moving our grain to, and part of it is just the seasonal patterns we're able to pick up on. Now this year, unfortunately, because it is such a strange year, our typical historical basis patterns are not going to be normal. They're not going to follow those typical patterns. So we have to kind of hit the reset button and start thinking about, as we move into the harvest period, what are those basis levels going to do? And so locking in the futures portion of the transaction and then locking in the basis portion separate has been a strategy we've used commonly up here. The challenge is going to be we have more dynamics this year than we have in the past.
Can you explain for a farmer in Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, how they would manage that? Because they do some of this, but it's likely that basis is going to do a lot of the heavy lifting depending on where you are in the Eastern Corn Belt.
Yeah, managing basis has always been a really tricky thing because there's no perfect way that you can hedge that per se. There's no way you can shift that risk off, whether it be a farmer or whether it be an elevator. There's two different strategies. One, of course, is to just try and make the forward cash sales, whether it be a forward contract or selling out of the bin, lock in the basis when you think it's at a good point. We do use hedge-to-arrive contracts up here, very similar to what you do in the Corn Belt. But, again, we kind of adjust the timing a little bit. The timing differentials can be different between when you lock in the futures and you lock in the basis. We do have some farmers that are doing basis contracts. It is a bit more common up here than you probably you'd see down in the Corn Belt. And that does provide some advantages. The challenge with a basis contract is typically the elevators will not go very far forward. They'd be willing to sign a basis contract 3 or maybe 4 months forward, but anything beyond that, then it gets to be very, very difficult and extremely risky for the elevator to offer as well. So, you know, there are some tools we have in our toolbox, but for basis management, basis right risk management, that's much more difficult.
Randy Martinson yesterday on Twitter, a grain company called Arthur Companies from about 70 miles to the north and west of Fargo, managed to tweet out that they were sending 115 cars to the Eastern Corn Belt to fill demand there. I suspect probably going into the state of Illinois, and we can figure it might be going to central Illinois. How can that happen given what we know about the situation on the ground today?
Well, part of what's happening here is, it's kind of what Frayne was alluding to, our basis levels are usually always negative up in our region, and we have plenty of corn, and we've got farmers that are willing to sell it because they need to make room and they get cash flow. So we've got a lot of producers that right now that are willing to move product. As far as the Corn Belt, they're not so willing to move product right now. They need the product. Basis levels are skyrocketing, and elevators trade on basis. So they're being able to buy it from the producer at a lower basis up here in the north, ship it to Illinois at a much higher basis than they can get here, and that's where they're making their difference on. They're being able to move it just because of the good spread in the basis.
This is sometimes, actually all the time, what we call arbitrage.
Right, so think of it as water. Water, and what Randy's saying to add on to that, is water is going to seek its own level, right? So you can't have a puddle here and be lower over there and think it's not going to run that way. So the where they want the grain is out east. We have it here. That's nothing new. And they're going to get it. We're going to help them do it. So things will normalize. Harvest will be crazy. Farmers are all bulled up. And unfortunately, they might be $5.50, $6 bullish in a $4.50, $4.75 corn market. When you look at soybeans and wheat, they're still not profitable for many of our growers. If you're dependent on government subsidies to make a profit and all bowled up, you should really scratch your head and ask yourself, what are you doing about 2020 and 2021? There may be the opportunity there to sell some corn also.
Farmers in the Northwest Corn Belt are used to using Prevent Plant. They're used to using trying to manage some of this cash flow. What do you know about how they do that and what you see, you think you see reflected in the Eastern Corn Belt at this point?
Yeah, typically, because we've had, historically, this is a prairie pothole region. We've had a lot of Prevent Plant in the past. Typically, what happens in those years where we have very low acreage and or lower yield production, what ends up happening is you get very conservative in your marketing plans. You're looking at the grain that's in the bin as that cash reservoir you're going to be able to need to market. You become more conservative. You know that there isn't the bushels out in the field, so you pool the bushels in the field plus the bushels in the bin, and you hope you can come out at the end of the day. Right now, today, you know, we have a pretty decent crop coming, especially for corn and beans. We're a little bit behind normal, but crop conditions are actually relatively nice in this region. So as Randy was mentioning, you know, the grain that's in the bin right now is a little looser. It's a little easier to get rid of that because you need to clean those bins out to make room for the new crop coming in. If the new crop coming in is not going to be very extensive, you're going to be holding tight on the old crop. And I do suspect, because of the cash flow demands and the concern about yield potential in the Eastern Corn Belt, the grain that's in the bin that you know what how many bushels you've got and the quality you've got becomes really hard to get rid of when there's this uncertainty on how many bushels you're going to be bringing in at the end of the year.
But should it be hard for them to get rid of?
That's a great question. I mean, psychologically, it's very tough. It really is.
You deal with this all the time here.
I do deal with this all the time. And I understand that at the end of the day, you still have to answer to the banker. You still have to make your cash flow. And so, again, you become as bullish as possible. And there are times you lose some opportunities because you're overly optimistic about what might happen because you're in that hopeful mode. And that becomes really, really hard to let go of those bushels and say, you know, this is probably the best we're going to be able to do and settle that out and try and move on. That's really tough.
How do you manage it?
Well, I Frayne's right. I mean, it's tough to sell it. But right now, I'm telling guys, if you've got a good basis or, you know, it's a five-year better than ever you've seen before basis or five-year, sell the cash, buy a call option. You know, have ownership in paper because it's a lot easier to check paper when you just pull it up on your computer than go out to the bin and check it. So that's kind of what I'm telling producers. Have ownership with call options. I like using short-dated ones, the September. They're based off December. They're going to expire in August. We're going to get through that August report. They're not that expensive, and I think they're working well for producers. So that would be my recommendation, is let the cash go on a strong basis, re-own it on the paper with a call option.
So, Tommy, here we have more seasonal moves in basis levels in this part of the world, as these folks have told us. However, in Indiana, where you come from, and Illinois, where I come from, there are seasonal moves, but they're not nearly as strong. And producers probably look at the basis, unless they're near an ethanol plant at this point, and say, I've seen this before and not so long ago.
Well, the interesting point about Indiana and Illinois is, as you know, a lot of those guys sell right off the combine or they'll pay for storage for a month or two. It's interesting to see the people who are calling farmers who normally wouldn't pay attention to them in that area and all of a sudden are asking them out on a date. So these end users, it's been a long time. It's been a long time since the end user's been caught short. And the farmer's the natural long. The end user's caught short. They're a little embarrassed because they're not doing a great job originating grain. And the farmer knows that, and so they're holding the bushels tight. And it's very interesting.
So what you're telling me is the bid you get, or the one you see, may not be the bid you can get.
It's good to know your end user and talk to them politely and say please and thank you. Things magically could get a dime better quickly.
How do things change going forward, do you think, as we get to the August crop production report and the resurvey that USDA will do for corn and soybeans across the whole of the Midwest?
Well, it's going to be an extremely volatile summer. And I think the volatility in corn prices are going to be much higher than they are for soybeans. partially because we have the extra carryover stocks from last year. We still don't have any kind of trade agreement with the Chinese, our number one customer. Export sales for new crop soybeans are still under a lot of question. My personal bias is I don't think we're going to get any kind of a trade deal anytime soon. And so what I'm suggesting is farmers be very serious about trying to price their beans and be more aggressive on the soybean side. On the corn side, again, because of the volatility, if you do see an opportunity, in particular for old crop, make sure you do some pricing on it. To gamble on the new crop, given the uncertainty about yields, I can understand, you know, the farmer's position on that and not wanting to get too front sold, not knowing what's going to happen later on. But that August time period is going to be a really, really important, not only from a weather and a crop development standpoint, but we're going to get some more accurate information on what it looks like the total crop picture is going
to
be.
So, Randy, I want you to talk to me a little bit about the decision process that farmers in this part of the world went through as the rains continued to fall. I think maybe they were thinking, well, spring wheat, small grain, fine, can't get that. Corn, fine, maybe, can't get that. Dang it, I got to do soybeans. But how does that look this past fall? And now as we enter year two of a trade dispute with China, what do they look forward to in the next season?
Well, you know, this was a kind of a tough year as far as getting the crop in, and especially, I know even on our farm, you know, wheat left quite early, as you mentioned. When we were getting into the end of May, we were hoping we could get some corn in, because corn is king, especially in the southeast corner of North Dakota. Soybeans usually get put on some of the poorer ground, because it's whatever's left that the corn can't get put on is where we plant the soybeans. So then that's kind of, you see that in the APH yields. Going forward right now, I think there was more corn, or at least attempted to try to get in. Soybeans were put in where they had to be, but there's going to be a lot of prevent plant in especially the southeast corner here. What we're seeing so far is somewhere between 25 to 40% of operations seeing acres not planted. So some of it was kind of maybe hung up a little bit soon, but we are going to see a big prevent plant issue in the southeast. Going forward, next year, there's going to be a lot of corn put in. We're going to see a tremendous lot of guys wanting to plant corn. Prices right now are in that 415, 410, 415 area for next year. And like I said, corn has been consistent. They've been able to get a little bit better yields. It's been able to cash flow a lot better. We're going to see a lot of corn planted up in this area next year.
Will that be the case, you think, across the whole of the Corn Belt? There'll be a lot of corn acres at this point put in. And then I'll ask all three of you what that means for next year's crop marketing, because we are only in the month of July, but it would be possible.
Well, the USDA doesn't think there's much prevent plant, but I can give you a name of 20 guys who sell corn seed who are really bummed out. They're only going to make half what they made last year because that seed came back. I physically have seen it. I spent a day at Beck Seed in Atlanta, Indiana, and just watched semis bring back seed. So there's prevent plan out there, and boy, are those seed companies going to be willing to get rid of some two-year-old seed at a really great price. So, yeah, there's going to be an incredible amount of corn planted, and your best opportunity to sell corn for next year might be this year. If you're scared to sell it, protect it. People don't like always futures and options. It's what we do. It's easy for us to talk about it, but get a floor set. The thing I like about protecting corn for next year is that the election's on November 2nd or 3rd, and the DEIS 20 corn puts expire November, say, 20th. And so you can protect a $4 floor right now for next year, get through whatever president we're going to have, regardless of your political connections or affiliations or opinions. And it's kind of nice going to your banker and saying, hey, it's nothing special, but I got a $4 floor for corn next year. How you like that?
That's exactly right. I think that's a good way to look at it. And, you know, the idea is to be risk management, take risk off the table. Best way to do that for protecting next year's crop is using options. I don't even mind selling some way far out of the money call options to help pay for it. Kind of, you know, you locked your floor, but then you've also put your ceiling in, but you're looking at that ceiling probably being up in the upper fives with the premiums that are being offered out there for some of those call options. So I do like that idea, and I think that is the best route to go.
Yeah, I want to focus a little bit on the timing issues. I agree with the strategy. The strategy's sound. I do think, especially for corn, farmers need to be more aggressive in their forward pricing for 2020 corn. just because I agree. I think we're going to see, in by the time we get into spring planting for 2020, there's going to be a lot of interest in increased corn acres, and the market adjusts very quickly to those kinds of numbers. So to be more aggressive in the forward pricing at this stage of the game, as we get into this August time period, once we get into the flowering and pollination stages, when we get a better read on what fall weather might be, if we're going to have some frost damage or some frost problems, when we get those spikes in the corn market, to start looking into the 2020 and doing the forward pricing in that for those acres, I think is going to be a really, really important strategy.
So the academics have told me, I think this is the second time in 30 years that they've said any time before December, go ahead and look at marketing the next year's crop. What do you do with soybeans?
Soybeans is a much tougher picture. Because really right now the soybean market is tied very heavily, not only obviously to the planted acreage and the potential yields for 2019, but as we move into 2020, that's really going to be more dictated, in my opinion, by what happens with the trade agreements and how quickly we can get some kind of agreement with China. And more importantly, not only the timing of the agreement, but what kind of structure is that agreement going to have.
So the secondary problem, or maybe it could be a primary problem, with talking about China and a settlement of the dispute, certainly could be ASF and their actual demand for product.
Yeah, it's a great point, valid point. But we recently, China, if not that we ever believe what they say, but they came out with numbers that their soybean meal usage wasn't down that much due to being fed to a lot more chickens, turkeys, and anything else that'll eat anything, right? So with all those people out there who need to be fed, I'm sorry, the hogs died, but they need to be fed something, and they're kind of getting used to our Western diet. So think big picture. Take a break from 6 months or a year out. Think 5 years out, and China's going to need our soybeans, and they're going to become a great customer. We're probably going to lose this trade war, and of course the president will tout it as if he won, but I think we've already lost, and we'll move on from there. And the growers in North Dakota and Minnesota and South Dakota need that to happen so we can start selling grain out of the PNW again.
It seems that you might have painted a pretty fundamentally better picture. The conversion rate for poultry is much better than it is for hogs. I think it's 1.2, 1.5, something like that. Aquaculture is almost 1-to-1, and hogs are a much higher rate. So the difference is going to be, that's going to be important to understand, and how many soybeans in particular they're going to need to take.
Yeah, and you know, to follow up on Tommy's point, and you're absolutely right. There has been a lot of substitution going on. As pork production has dropped, they have substituted to other proteins, animal protein specifically. But the other thing that typically happens in this, and we see this in the United States, when our cattle numbers are down, total beef pounds of beef meat that was produced actually didn't drop as much. And what happens is you take the animals you have, you feed them a little bit more, and you have higher slaughter weights. And so there is this natural compensation that's going on. It's always shaky to try and come up with numbers from China and understand what's going on there, because they're very private and it's very difficult. And to be very blunt, they have a lot of backyard producers that are very, very hard to track when it comes to feed consumption as well as total hog production. And when we look at the cut in the hog herd, or the breeding herd specifically, which is where I'm really focused, is not the actual hogs that died, it's the sows that died, that a lot of those are at the local production level. It's in those backyard lots. The real question in my mind for how quickly can get African swine fever under control, and then how quickly can they transition to a confinement-based production system? Because it's only under the confinement-based system that you can actually get these disease and the spread of disease under control.
What did the world numbers tell you about the marketplace for the day?
Well, we have too much grain. We have too much corn, too much wheat, too much beans. We personally were oversold here in the States. When we get oversold, people see it on sale. You see tenders show up overnight, and Egypt comes in for wheat. They'll buy it from anyone. They don't care who they buy it from. And so when grain gets cheap enough, you know, people need to be fed. And unfortunately, people across the world are going to produce grain at under their cost production. And right now it's the United States government subsidizing them to make up that difference, in my opinion.
What do we know about the competition from South America and what they might do this fall?
Oh, boy, that's a good question. You know, I mean, I do know that right now there's a lot more Amazon deforestation taking place. I mean, they're tearing up a lot more of the rainforest. This new president they've got and their Secretary of Ag is basically a production guru, to say the least, one that's more tied to production agriculture. So they're looking at increasing acreage, and they do have about two-thirds of their acres left that can be somewhat cleared and brought into production. So I wouldn't bet that right now, because of the financial structure, they're going to bring in more than 5% or increase their acres by 5% this next year. But they're gearing up to start bringing in land and bringing it in at a pretty good rate.
Is there any likelihood, Frayne, that they might plant more first crop corn?
It is possible, depending on what happens here in the States. I mean, obviously, their production cycle is, at least for the first crop corn, is half off of ours. So they'll have a pretty good read on what our yield and yield potential might be. Markets respond very quickly. That sends this pricing signal into South America as well. They'll get a pretty good understanding of that. And obviously, if our corn prices go higher, they can easily respond to higher corn prices also. Now, most of the corn production, at least especially first crop corn production, is in the southern regions, which are closer to the ports. That also tends to be their exportable stocks of corn, because that's where, again, they're producing close enough to the port they can truck it in. When you get into the Mato Grosso, the central parts, that usually tends to be the second crop corn. That tends to stay more domestic in its usage, not really hit the export market. So we do have to keep that in mind. And the potential for expansion, in particular in Brazil. Argentina, I don't know that we're going to get the expansion in Argentina because they don't have those available expansion acres like they do in Brazil. So really, in my opinion, Brazil is going to be the country to watch, not as much as Argentina. They're more stable.
If it's first crop corn out of Brazil in the exportable position, it would seem to me that the southeastern part of the United States, which won't have nearly as much grain to feed into it, could be a pretty exciting destination for them.
And we've already seen some shipments of South American corn hit that that eastern corn market. And again, it's like Tommy said, you know, the basis level is that signal that the cash market is sending to say, where do we have a surplus of grain and where do we have a deficit of grain? And that is a strong signal on where do we need to move the grain from what point A to point B. Even though it sounds unusual, in 2012 we saw North Dakota trains and North Dakota corn shuttles headed to the eastern corn belt, into the ethanol plants and into some of the feed mills in Iowa. Some of them extended in Illinois. Now, because of the problems that we're seeing in the eastern corn belt, it wouldn't be surprising that if we have a really good corn crop here in this part of the world, that we see grain moving east, which is very unusual, but that's what the market's signaling.
As we close out our time together, I want you to consider soybeans and corn both, probably corn old and new crop, but start with soybeans and what farmers should do about marketing new crop, if anything, at this time, or what your plan would be.
Well, I'll start with that. Farmers are going to do whatever the heck they want to do, and that's why we love them, all right? That giggling you hear in the background is Randy Martinson and Doctor. They're going to do what they do. I mean, people like us try to help them. Call us experts, call us idiots, whatever you want. But the farmer's going to do what they want to do. Soybeans have more potential to go up than they think. If I could leave you with any point and not answer your question, is watch the value of space this year. There is physically less bushels out there than normal, and these harvest lows may not happen. And if they do, they always happen. But we're going to rock it out of there. Maybe through basis, not through futures. Watch the value of space. If you don't understand that, hire someone to educate you on what that means. Space is going to be worth a lot this year.
Space and drying capacity both.
Oh, yeah.
On opposite ends, yeah. Potentially.
That's a really good point Tommy makes. I mean, I know my brother's saying he's going to produce half the bushels this year than he did last year. Well, of course, we have room to store that because with half the bushels. But looking at it in the big picture, you know, I agree that soybeans have a lot more potential than people give them credit for. That's a market you never undersell because it's always one that somehow has the resilience to always bounce back and humble us at times that we don't expect. Corn, I think that's one that's a little more methodical. I mean, it demands a little bit more consistent right now, I would say, for the corn side than soybeans, especially with the export market out of it for us up here in the north. But I guess I would just be looking at good levels and producers selling at those levels when they can. And look at, if you're not, you know, liking the sale, have ownership of it or buy puts to protect yourself. Just use some other tools available.
Boy, where to start? You know, I'm going to be a little bit counterintuitive to these guys. I do think the corn market has probably some more volatility for old crop, but also some new crop. I'd be looking at that August, September time period as, because that's going to be where the volatility is at, setting your pricing objectives and sticking to them. Now that you've got a cool head and you've got a sense for where your cash flow might be, even though it's an educated guess, put in some pricing targets, make sure that you make those sales when those price targets are hit. Because we tend to get overly bullish, especially in corn, when we have a production shortfall. And as prices come up, that also means buyers start to back away. And the first buyer to back away from the U.S. corn market is the export market. And the export market is very price sensitive. There is not a shortage of world corn exports right now. We tend to be the largest, but we're not the only game in town. And so, yeah, domestic users, ethanol, the feed guys, they tend to be they're the last ones to hang on. And when we get really, really high prices, it's a fight between those two because the export market has already dropped out. But right now, we still have decent export sales. We need to continue to have decent export sales to have price support. And those guys are very price sensitive. On the soybean side, I do think that we have more soybean acres planted than we expected. There's likely going to be volatility because obviously we got a lot of weather left. We've got a lot of summer left. We don't know what the yield is going to be. My opinion, yields are going to be much more important than acreage in the final production numbers. And so there could be some sparks in soybeans. But given the carryover we have from last year, and I'll be very blunt, I'm not optimistic that we're going to get any kind of a trade deal soon, which means that number one customer we have in the export market that chews up a tremendous amount of soybeans is not going to be back in the market for a while. And so, again, we won't have large price recovery in soybeans unless there's a really horrible yield.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may listen to the whole of our program online, on demand, anytime you'd like. The address is willag.org. You can also find us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, on Stitcher, SoundCloud, and, of course, the NPR One app. Our panelists for the week included Randy Martinson of Martinson Ag Risk Management from right here in Fargo, North Dakota. And that's where we are originating from, actually, the malt plant in Moorhead, Minnesota, but they're twin cities. We're also joined from Mayville, North Dakota, by Tommy Grisafi, and, of course, from NDSU, North Dakota State University, Frayne Olson has been our guest as well. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.